Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 297, my chat with podcaster Chris Green. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. It's the beginning of January, so I'm sure you have started on some new workout routine or fulfilling all sorts of new resolutions about how you're going to be better. And let me just tell you, one of the things that you can do that pretty much you can set it and forget it is get an Audible account. Once you have this account, it's available to you anytime you want, and there's always new books. And every month when you get your new credit, you can get something new. Like, it's a great place to access books and podcasts, and there's all sorts of like special things they're creating on their own. So it's just a really good place to find entertainment and enrich yourself and fulfill one of those resolutions, which I'm sure is reading more books. Everyone adds it every year. So, you know, go to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy, sign up and get your account today. Come on. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is a business that my husband and I are running to help podcasters. We are here for you. We can give you any kind of services that you are looking for. Are you looking for assistance with editing? Can we help you with your website? Are you not sure how to write a script for a podcast? Are you like, wait, how do I get my podcast on all of the different apps? Like, if there are questions where we can help you, just let us know. We want to be there for you. And our website, podcastcadet.com, has a bunch of free videos and tips on there already. So go check it out. If you want more help from us, call us. We'll give you a consultation. And then, you know, if you end up buying something from us, you can use the code YBY20 and get 20% off. We just want to help other podcasters have fun and do cool things like we're doing. And if we can help you do a new resolution, which is start a podcast and make it easier on you, let us help at podcastcadet.com. This week on Yes But Why, I interviewed Chris Green, host and producer of the Gravity Beard podcast, This Week Today podcast, and Armchair Radio, among many, many others. Listen in as we chat about the Parking Lot movie, Dallas Comedy House, and Johnny Carson. This is a great chat, and Chris is so, so funny. You guys are really going to enjoy it. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 297. Chris Green creates fun content for his own little corner of the internet. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is
Yes But Why.
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 This is the Yes But Why podcast.
All right, so let's kick it off by talking about your childhood.
So I have two siblings. I have an older sister and a younger sister. My older sister is 3 years older, but my younger sister is 9.5 years younger.
Whoa.
So she came along. Yeah, she was a pleasant, unplanned surprise later. Now, ironically, I think I get along better with my younger sister, but I get along with them both fine. So for a long time, it was just me and my older sister. And it was pretty traditional in the older sibling making the younger sibling do things. Like, she'd give me really horrific haircuts that we'd both get in trouble for, or she'd, you know, I was super gullible as a child, so she would trick me into things, or, you know, that kind of thing. Until I was 4.5, we lived up north, so we did have a basement, so a lot of child crime happened in the basement. Not crimes on children, but, you know, things that kids do that they later get in big trouble for.
Yeah.
Like, I did leap off the couch and clunk my head into the corner of the TV stand and blood gushed from my head. So those sorts of things. Other than that, pretty normal stuff. You know, played a little bit of organized sports until I was a little bit older, and I realized I was smaller than everyone else and was really terrible at it. So, but pretty normal childhood.
You were able to get out of organized sports? That's amazing. Your parents allowed that?
I think my lack of ability allowed me to get out of organized sports.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, I guess that's probably true. We are around the same age, and we were the last generation where they actually cared what the true skill level of the children was when they played sports. Now they're like, everyone gets a trophy. And you're like, this guy just sat in the corner and kicked like rocks the whole time. We're giving him a trophy? Yes.
That guy ate dirt. I saw him.
Yeah. He just walked in from his dad's car. He just walked onto the field. What? Like, yeah.
Can't start the game in the seventh inning.
What's going on?
I mean, I did things, you know, like build ramps to jump my bike, you know, with bricks and plywood. You know, of course, back then we didn't.
You're jumping off of couches. You're mm-hmm. you're building ramps. Were you a daredevil? Were you constantly getting hurt?
You know, I see why you asked that follow-up question, but actually, no. I'm a pretty careful person. Now, we'll make it to this later. But my own middle child, Noah, he is that. Like, he climbs the top of anything, including very, very tall trees or playground equipment, or like he took up rock. We put him in rock climbing because we're like, this kid loves to climb, and he was extremely good at it. Like, he doesn't have a level of self-preservation like I do.
Wow.
Like, he has enough that he's still living, but my middle child, I don't know where he got that from. Maybe it was from me, and it just didn't manifest in me that much. Yeah.
I don't know that it's a genetic thing. I mean, like, it sounds like it is a little bit for your child, but I feel like as parents, we try to assign more of these, like, genetic ideas, like, oh, he's like me, she's like, and I think about my parents, and I'm like, who am I like? What are they? What parts of them am I really taking after? And everyone in my family had like a thing they'd say, oh, you're just like your dad in this way. Oh, you're just like your uncle in that way. Whatever various things that they decided that I was like. But I don't know. I think we're all just wild anomalies that just pop out and you're like, okay, how am I going to deal with this kid? Like, so yeah, I wonder, fault.
Yeah, there's certain things I can identify that I relate to each of my parents, but I think you might be right also. I think we might oversubscribe that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like we as humans are like already trying to overanalyze the like true meaning of our lives when it's like, what are these monkeys doing? They figured out how to create a computer. Can't they be happy for that? Like, and then we're like, tell me the true deeper meaning. And they're like, I'm not sure what to tell you. You're in a spinning ball in the sky. I don't know. Like, it's just funny how we try to like understand our children and this like longer sense of who we are through like our ancestors. Like, I'm like looking up old things about my ancestors. Like, ah, yes, makes sense now that I'm like that. Like, no, it doesn't. Like,
yeah, existential questions might be overrated. I think that's what you're saying, and I think I might agree. Like, just keep looking forward. Doesn't matter.
Just live your life, man. Have a good time. Enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Oh, man. So you were able to get out of organized sports. I'm very deeply impressed with this idea that you were able to do that, and I'm glad that they let you out. What was your activity when you didn't do that? Or were your parents, I mean, it was the 80s, so they were probably like, yeah, whatever, just go somewhere, and as long as we don't see you, we don't care what it is. But what was your activity? Did you do, like, D&D, or, you know, did you get involved in math club or debate?
God, that's a good question. No one's ever asked me what filled the void.
If nothing, and if it was just school and friends, like, that makes sense.
I'm super average at a lot of stuff. Like, I'm not great at any one thing. And so I wasn't a great athlete. I wasn't super smart. I'm not an idiot, and I'm not completely clumsy. And so what filled the void? The thing about it is all the way through school, you know, most kids are aspiring to be part of sports, and I wanted to be part of sports. But the problem is that when I graduated high school, I think I was like 5'4" and 125 pounds, you know, and so I always looked. So if I was supposed to be 18, I looked like I was 13, you know, and that's not good for dating. It's not good for sports. It's not good for any of those things, you know, any of the things that are currency in the world of a child.
Sure.
And so I distinctly remember, like, I had to go. I wasn't going to make the baseball or football, any of the major sports, but you still have to have athletic credits. You have to have PE credits. So I literally, I was like, ah, I don't want to be in PE because in the 80s, that's where all the losers went. And or the troublemakers or the guys that, you know, and I'm talking about perceptions of that type. I'm sure all those kids weren't losers. I'm sure they're just fine. But again, in the world of, in the world of children, you know, you go to sports, like you either go to sports or sports. And so I did PE, I did gymnastics for a semester. I did, you know, anything to get my PE credits, somehow. And, cause I was just small. I was small. And this will play out for the rest of our conversation today. To this day, I'm tragically underconfident. Like, I have no self-confidence whatsoever. So even if I was going to overachieve athletically or otherwise, it wasn't going to happen because I was handcuffed by my lack of confidence. Always have been. That's been a common thread forever, as long as I've been around.
I feel like you were clear with that when you told me you were a mediocre individual that wasn't smart enough or good at sports. I was like, yeah, I feel like we checked off lack of confidence right there, as that was the thing that you were telling me. No, in my childhood, I had nothing. Like, hey, man, I didn't do sports either. I did some sports here and there, but I left public school because I was getting bullied and went to the all-girls school, and then they did not ask me to do much. I mean, I had one coach try to convince me to get into running, and like, I remember I did it for like 3 weeks, and the whole time I was like, bless your heart that you think I'm going to keep doing this. Like, she was like, yeah, you're doing great. Like, I'd run real slow, like everyone else would be running off, and she'd run right next to me like, yeah, you're doing it. Oh my God, this is so great. We're just like moving forward. And I was like, oh, aren't you sweet? Like, I see what you're trying, and like, that matters. Like, I want you to know that it matters. You're a good teacher, but I'm not mm-hmm. gonna be the one that you're gonna really get. Okay, yeah. So
for sure. And I did good in school.
Oh, you're good. Real smart, eh? Nice.
No, I'm not real smart.
Ah.
but I did fine in school. I did fine in school up until, you know, math got harder. You know, I took sure. I don't know. 8th grade algebra and 9th grade geometry, and you know, went on that track. I mean, I took calculus as a senior in high school and hated every second of it. And when I told my because the big thing was, if you're in calculus as a senior, then you take the AP calculus class, because then I don't know, you what is it used? You test out of college, whatever it is.
Yeah, it gets you out of college math. So
yeah, so all the kids that were doing really well in calculus took the AP test, and I went to my teacher, and she was a sweet lady. She really was. But when I said, hey, I want to take the AP test, she instinctively laughed, like immediately laughed. That was her response in that moment to me, was she laughed and did not hold the laughter back. It's not like she started to laugh and then covered her mouth and like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry for laughing. She laughed.
Like, for a while. Like, she's like, hold on, Chris.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, my stomach hurts. That kind of laughter.
Yeah, she's like, you are a comedian. And you're like, wait, yeah. No, I'm not. That's not what I'm trying to do.
No, this is not a joke. I want to take the, and I don't remember, honestly, don't, that's the end of that memory for me. I don't remember if I took the AP test or not. Maybe I didn't. I don't remember how it scored, but I did. But, and then of course I had to take calculus in college anyways. So.
Oh, well, then you didn't take the AP test.
Or I took it and I did quite poorly.
Sure. I suppose that's
maybe
true.
Possible, but.
He was like, are there more math tests available for me? Could I sign up for extra ones? And they're like, what?
There's the ACT and the SAT is in the one that people don't care about as much. Can I take that one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there other tests? Like, well, hilariously, the college I went to made us take an additional test. Like, I had to take a placement test. Once I, like, agreed to go there, signed all the things, then they sent a test, which I had to bring to my high school and get proctored on the weekend by a teacher, and just sat there and, like, did this test. And it was just basic stuff. My favorite part was I went all the way through, took all the math stuff, took a bunch of extra science classes, because in my mind, I was going to do science because that was the right thing to do. And as soon as I went to college, I took all the placement tests to get into these like high level science and math courses. And then I got in. And then as soon as I got in, I realized my true fate was having to continue to do these things. And I quit and switched to a theater major. So
good for you.
So many unnecessary tests.
Yeah, I tried to be a finance major, which was a really good idea, but my brain didn't understand finance.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's a rough one. That was your like, I'm going to be responsible. I'm going to be a finance major.
Yes. I intentionally tried to get into business school. I wanted to be a finance. And then I took my first econ class, which I loved. Oh. And I wanted to be. Either get a double major or at least get a minor. They didn't do minors where I went to school, but I would have gotten enough credits to basically qualify with an econ minor. But I'll pause right there and I'll just say, I've always felt like I could have taken at least two or three, maybe more paths, like had totally distinct lives and been perfectly happy in any of them.
Huh. That's really interesting. Do. Are you like generally content?
No. No, I'm not.
Okay.
Another great follow-up question, but no, the answer is no. I battle trying to be content. I should be content for a lot of reasons, but I battle that. I'm not really sure why.
I like that there's a voice. Well, I don't think any of us are really truly content, but the way that you presented this idea that you could be happy doing various different paths, I was like, oh, what a nice, like, open view of life, that it's like, hey, man, no matter what path appears in front of me, I'm going to have a good time. I was like, oh, that sounds so lovely. And you're like, no. No,
yep,
no.
Wrong conclusion. No. The actual truth is I'm an anxious person, and I look at it more of opportunity cost, and maybe I chose the wrong path.
Ah, I see.
Yeah.
Oh man. Well, that's great. I feel like a heavy dose of anxiety is just perfect when you're a creative person trying to find something to do. What did you end up doing? Like, I know you from your podcast, but I don't know, what's your job?
I'm in retail commercial real estate.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if I had a finance background in my industry, that's the one distinction that if you had it, you have a leg up on everyone else. So, and I didn't get into real estate on purpose. That's a whole nother story.
Sure.
But serendipitously, or maybe in my case, the opposite of serendipity. If I would have succeeded in finance and then accidentally later got into real estate like I did, I would have a distinct advantage over my peers.
Yeah. I see. Yeah. I mean, if real estate agents want to do anything, it's one up the other real estate agent. So that's definitely good.
That's another thread on the sweater I'm not going to pull, but I have something to say about that. But if you want to briefly go back to childhood,
please.
The reason I pursued business and not one of these other three or four paths that I think I could have taken is because in my household, my mother is clearly the creative person. Between my parents. My father doesn't seem to be, I think if we peeled the layers of the onion, he probably is, but he didn't exhibit any creativity of any kind in terms of artistically. He didn't have interest in artistic things or creating things. He was, but he had the biggest personality in my household. I mean, it was a very traditional household from that time that I'm sure you're familiar with. And our whole home and family revolved around my dad. My mother taught for 4 years art, actually. Until my sister was born, and then left the work. I'm having trouble with words. Stopped working.
Stopped doing the lucrative job of art teaching.
Of art teaching in 1968. Yeah, super lucrative. And but also she did that gladly. I mean, she wanted to be a mom and a homemaker and was happy to do that. And I've got an amazing mother. And I've got a great dad too. He was a tough guy to be around, but he was a great dad. But the point is that he was the pragmatic one. He was the practical one. He's an entrepreneur. He's, you know, maybe that's where his creativity comes. I'm very risk averse. He's not risk averse. He's happy to take risks. But I think I followed him. My mom was less influential on me as a child than my dad was. And so I took a practical, I graduated high school saying, I'm going to go get a business degree because I need to be able to apply that out in the world somewhere in a way that I can make money and take care of myself. So I took a very practical approach. But what I was referencing earlier is that, you know, now we fast forward to 10 or 11 years ago, which we can dig into as much as you want to, but that's really where I realized, oh my gosh, I'm a creative person. And then I look back and there were different markers along the way that said, oh yeah, you were artsy and creative, but that wasn't encouraged.
Yeah.
That wasn't nurtured. Your creative side that you clearly got from your mother probably was never nurtured or recognized or encouraged, like really weird stuff. That's the great thing about this, your podcast, is because it digs into these things. But I remember at a Christmas party at our neighbor's house where I sat down at a drum set and, you know, banged on the drums a little bit. My dad said, knock off that racket kind of thing. So I immediately put it down. When we were talking before we started, you referenced, you know, doing interviews with your stuffed animals. My imaginary friend was Johnny Carson. And then in college, I recorded stupid stuff with my roommate on his computer, and it was comedy adjacent. So there was different markers along the way. Oh, when I was 16, I came home from being in Colorado for a month where there was guys that I dormed with that played guitar, and I was like, I've always wanted to play guitar, and I insisted that I don't leave there without knowing how to play guitar. And so I went home and I said, Dad, I want to buy a guitar. And if I say something like that to my dad, he's always on board. But the way it goes is okay, we're going to go to the store, we're going to buy the guitar, and then he's checking out. Like, guitar purchased, box checked. He's not going to check back with me. He's not going to want to hear me play. He's not going to he's the practical one. He wants to encourage and provide for his family. That was a big, big deal to him. But that's the box that's going to be checked, and that he has no interest in it.
Yeah.
And if my dad wasn't interested, he didn't fake interest in something. He just didn't participate. So I got a guitar when I was 16, and I know how to play guitar, which I'm super pumped about. But that was the extent of his involvement in nurturing my creativity.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, you want that thing? We'll get you that thing. And then good luck with that. That sort of thing.
Yeah. I find that, as you mentioned, you know, with these interviews that I'm doing, that a pattern emerges that, you know, parents try to tell their kids to be practical, and especially, you know, especially if one of them has some artistic bent and the other one doesn't, because probably your father witnessed your mom being an art teacher and how, like, maybe she was great at it, but they certainly didn't pay her what she was worth. So he was like, well, they're not going to pay you, so why do it, right? The whole point here is to make money, and now that I figured out how to do it, I will do that in that scenario. But I also wonder, like, you're learning how to be yourself as a reflection of what he presented, and I wonder what his parents said to him that then led him to become that way, right? So, like, we're all sort of a rejection of our parents in whatever way. And we might love them, but no matter what, something about them is a thing that we reject to become ourselves, right? And so it's really fascinating to hear, and it happens a lot sort of generationally, the parents of people that I talk to, this way of being sort of tight about going outside of themselves, about being creative. And many, many, many parents of adult artists right now are people who are like, yeah, I don't think that that's the right move. You really shouldn't do that. Don't do that. Stay in your own lane. Get a job in something solid, right? And I appreciate that you tried. You know, like, that finance was your first effort, the way biology was my first effort. And then it was like, yeah, no, that's not who I am, though. And the beauty of our generation being that we have the freedom to decide what we like and to make those decisions. And even you're talking about how there were various paths that you like, oh, I tried this and I could have done that, but I decided not to. And that, even that freedom is great. You know, there's something wonderful about our generation having the ability to see that there are options for ourselves and then go down whichever one ends up feeling comfortable, right? Also, by the way, real estate seems to make total sense with your vibe. Like, you know, as far as like talking to people and connecting and like I mentioned earlier with your podcast, you're really great at community building. So like, you know, what is real estate if not building a community, right? So it's like, oh, all these people, you're like, oh, you're going to love this place. Oh, the other guys in this strip mall, oh, they're so cool. You're going to have the best. Your spot's going to be the coolest spot, of course. But, you know, so like even just selling the idea of real estate is, it seems to be right up your alley as far as like skills that I've seen you exemplify and how those can come together.
Well, that's an interesting observation because, I am intensely competitive, but I'm not able to do it in the sports arena, but I can do it in business.
Yeah.
I am probably pragmatic to a fault. I'm overly pragmatic, which I actually like, but it doesn't work in every situation. I am strategic. I like to plan, you know, I like consulting. Like those are all things you have to do in my work. There's a lot of things I don't like about it, but also it gives me unlimited freedom and an unlimited income potential. And I'm not overly materialistic, but I recognize that you have to make money to exist in the world. Mm-hmm. And for to be in a business or an industry where there's no cap on what you can make, it's kind of up to you. And you get to chart your own day and no one you don't have a boss or so. In a way, I think if you're going to be in the business world, except for being maybe just a straight up entrepreneur starting your own business, real estate is the closest you can get to being maybe artistic because it has all of that fluidity and flexibility and lack of oversight. And, you know, so that appeals to me very much. I can't work for someone. And now I've done this for over 20 years. I can't work in a normal job with a boss. Like I couldn't do it. I would get fired.
Yeah. It's so funny. I think real estate
artists
is like,
are like that, right? I mean, that's.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. 100%. The vibe of I can't work for other people. I need to be doing my own thing. 100%. 100%. Yeah. I was just thinking like, real estate is the only freelance job that gets any cred. Like everybody else doing freelance, they're like, oh, what's that? You're like a contractor. You like don't have a real job. That's like right. So sad for you. And it's like, it's not so sad. I'm not sad. Don't be sad for me. It's all right. Like I make more than you. And it's just because I'm doing, you know, 25 things, but I like doing 25 things. Like don't feel bad for me. But real estate, man, real estate's got some high cred. Like they're like, I don't know if you've heard about, owning property. And you're like, what? Oh my God, I would love to do that. That sounds like the best thing in the world, right?
It's like on the word own. I own it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the American dream, baby. Yeah. All I want to do is own stuff that's just a building that's on this piece of land. Give it to me. Parking spaces, I'll take it. So it's that and every single job I ever had, people were telling me I should get involved in sales. When you're a good creative person, people think that selling things is the right thing for you to do because you can pretend to care as you convince people to do things, which, yeah, I guess. Am I good at sales? No, I'm terrible at sales. I tried it a few times and then people were like, I'm so surprised. And I was like, okay, thank you for your surprise, I suppose. I'm so surprised you don't have that skill. No, thanks. But it's definitely a classic sort of creative vibe to be able to create this whole world, this mystique around what you're selling and convince people that they need it and then give it to them. Like, absolutely. You know, something really great about that. You mentioned a little bit earlier that there was a moment that, you know, you, we discussed these markers in your upbringing and growing up where you were like, oh yeah, I guess I was creative. But you said about 11 or so years ago was when you kind of allowed yourself to do something creative. What was the catalyst for that?
It's interesting. It was around that time, because real estate is very up and down, and that was a very down period. And there's been a handful of times, including a couple of years ago, where I was like, I'm going to run out of money. I need to go find something else to do. And in that, I don't know, 2009, 10, somewhere around there, was one of those times things weren't going so great. And it was around that time that documentaries were kind of emerging as much entertainment as they were informational. I don't know if you remember that period, but that's not, I mean, now they're right alongside movies, but there was a time when they were boring and informational and they weren't considered really entertainment. But they emerged around that time, and there was a movie called The Parking Lot Movie by a girl named Megan Ackman, I think, out of University of Virginia. And it was literally about some guys that worked as parking lot attendants at this parking lot, pay parking lot adjacent to the school. And it was really fantastic. I could watch it over and over and over. Even to this day, I love it. And in fact, it got enough attention that for a while she was in conversations to option it to NBC to adapt it into a TV show, and that didn't pan out. But I'm a big fan of the local sports talk radio station, and they've got a really, really great story. And that movie inspired me to want to make a documentary about the radio station, because the guys at the radio station, that just the tone of the station was very familiar with the parking lot, the guys from the parking lot. And I tried really, really hard to get that project off the ground, and it didn't happen. And then I had another idea for a documentary that I wasn't quite as excited about. And with, in the back end of the failure of the one about the radio station, I didn't pursue that one either. And then I had children, and like, it literally took me a year or two to not be able to do the documentary, and then my first child was born, and then your world changes, and it was off the table. But it was around that time that I thought, oh my gosh, I am a creative person, because my wife is incredibly creative. She is definitely a creative, unmistakably a creative. And I was in contrast to her, and in contrast in the household I grew up in, I was like, well, I'm way more like my dad. I never thought I was anything like my mother. And then I go marry an artist, and even in contrast to that, I'm like, well, I'm still the practical one. I'm not artistic. And it was that through that experience, I'm like, no, I actually am a creative. I fit in the community of creative people, and I'm a creative person. And then it kind of went from there. And I'm trying to think. I mean, I didn't even get into podcasting until 6 years later. So I'm trying to, I don't remember what the dots were in between, but that's where it started.
It's fascinating that you say, oh, finally, I fit into the community of creatives. I just want to say this out loud for anyone's listening. You don't have to fit into any group to be creative, both being creative just in your life. In the instance of this story started with, I needed to make more money, so I had to get creative about how I was going to do that. That creativity is for all of us. And then there's the artistic creation with artistic projects like documentaries or podcasts, whatever that might be. And even then, you don't need a community or a group of people at all to validate the fact that you can do that. And I'm saying that out loud, not just for you, Chris, but for the people who might be listening, so that they don't feel like, oh, well, if I can't find other people that want to do this with me, that it's not good enough. That is incorrect. You do whatever you want. You do it alone, potentially, or with other people. But if you have an idea, you want to create something, it is there. It is available for you. And just the thought that you had in your head is enough to keep that going. So I love this idea that you wanted to do this documentary. I loved the kind, sweet, like, caring that you had for this sports DJs, that you were like, I need their story to be out there. Like, even just caring about their story and wanting to, tell other people about how cool they were is a very creative pursuit. And I like appreciate the idea of the effort that you put to try to create it. Now, making a movie is a humongous ordeal, documentary or otherwise. So not actually accomplishing it should not be something that anyone is like, oh, well, he didn't make the movie. I bet you put a lot of effort into preparing and working on and talking to these people. And whether or not anything happened, you know, I can't tell you the number of screenplays I've written no one's ever read. Does that make them less than? No. No. They were a creative pursuit. They were an effort that we put out into the world where we were like, I see some joy and I want to spread that joy and this is what I want to do with it. Whether or not it ends up getting to the end user, you know, we're not in charge of how art disperses. We're just in charge of creating some, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think partly of what I just meant is I never thought I was a creative person.
Sure.
You know, I didn't think I was. And I did put a ton of time into unsuccessfully making that movie. I mean, it consumed me for a period of time. And I still feel to this day, I still feel just as strongly that that is a really, really good story that needs to be told. And a woman put a version of it out actually recently last year, but it only focuses on one guy. You know, credit to her for getting it done. And she did a pretty good job, but it's a small fraction of the story. Mm-hmm. And it's a really, really good story. It could be a feature film. It doesn't have to be a documentary, but I think it's better as a documentary.
Sure.
But my conviction that project needs to be done has not waned even a little bit.
You still can do it. I mean, you know, you can tell the story many years after the story is over. You know, how many documentaries, like sort of crime documentaries, have we seen recently come out on things like HBO where it's like, you know, 40 years ago, this woman stole $1 million. This is what she's up to now. And you're like, what? Yeah. Tell me everything, right? So yeah, why not like 20 years ago or 11 years ago, these two DJs had this wild situation. Check it out.
That's true, except at the time that I wanted to do it was the sweet spot because now people have died, you know, and sure, it was, and the stations changed. Mm. It's not.
So now it is a narrative feature film. We'll write it. It'll happen.
Yeah.
We'll get other people to play. Jake Gyllenhaal will be in it. It'll be great. It's going to be good.
But also you could probably, you know, relate that if enough time passes, then you're just in a different place in life and you're no longer the right person to do that project, even though it's still a great idea.
Like someone else needs
to. Yeah, I mean, I'm not the person anymore to do it. And honestly, I do believe that things either happen or don't happen for good reasons, for the right reasons. And I probably dodged a bullet. You know, I probably had an elephant by the tail and didn't know really what I was about to get myself into. And it's probably a good thing that I didn't go do that. I had it all planned. I was ready to pull the trigger and start executing, but it's probably fortunate that it didn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a big deal time in your life when you have your first child, for sure. I bet you your wife would have been displeased if instead of you being there to help her, she, you know, you were off filming your documentary and putting it all together. Yeah.
Yeah.
If she's like, does this documentary bring home formula for the child? And you're like, no, it does not. It's not part of, right. You know, we don't have formula and craft services. Sorry. We don't even have craft services, if that makes you feel any better. Oh, it doesn't? Oh, okay.
And also, you know, I would still have a full-time job that I would have to have done. So.
Oh, yes, there's that as well. Absolutely. Well, but you mentioned that you came up with this documentary idea when real estate was kind of like sort of slow. So I wondered if maybe like, you know, you had taken a break from doing it because there really wasn't any work to be done. And then tried to be a documentarian and then that didn't work out. And maybe somebody was like, hey, we got this real estate spot here. If you like to take care of this, and you're like, oh yeah, that's not how real estate jobs work. But you know,
no, you can't walk away because it's hard to get back in actually. It's easy on the residential side. It's hard on the commercial side.
Mm. You got to keep your foot in the door. You're like, I'm still relevant.
Yeah, that's right. You can't give up. If you walk away, you got to walk away for good. You can't come back in. It's hard. It's really hard to come back.
Fascinating. Yeah. Ins and outs of what it is to be a commercial real estate agent. That's
right.
That's some good info, though. I mean, hey, And probably a relatively good job to have when you're interested in doing artistic stuff if you can organize your own hours, because then, you know, say you want to still work on a short film or something like that, you can just arrange everything around each other as opposed to your normal office with like a 9-to-5 and like PTO and like, my boss won't let me get the day off, so I can't come film, guys. Instead, it's like, okay, well, I had 3 meetings at 8 a.m. and I'm done for the day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, my job lends itself really well to creative pursuits. Yeah, you know, I do things in the middle of the day that I probably shouldn't do, but in the context of my industry, it's fine. You know, it's a bottom line business. So if I'm on top of my stuff, then my time is my time.
Exactly.
So it's perfect.
Yeah. And to a certain extent, like in the world that we live in, you know, unless you're Brad Pitt, you need a job on top of the artistic pursuits that you're doing, because, well, you know, they don't just hand you money up front for your novel when you're just some person who's like, I'd like to put 2 words together here and see how that goes. That's not what they do, right? So yeah. To have this this kind of flexibility in your schedule, not terrible. Guys looking for a job out there, real estate always good. And P.S., real estate in Austin, amazing. Maybe swing by. Just kidding, don't. But let's talk about your, when you, I like this idea that you wanted to develop this film, that you like created this because you were interested in this story. Were there other stories that you were interested in before or after? Like, not necessarily in making a full film of, but like, you know, was storytelling and putting stuff out there something that you'd thought about doing?
Not before that. No, that was the first time. Got into documentaries, saw the Parking Lot movie, was already kind of obviously a longtime listener and had a deep understanding of that radio station. I thought, that's a perfect story. And that was kind of the genesis. That was the catalyst for me starting to think like a creative person. That's a story that needs to be, like, the idea of, in my head, of identifying a story that needs to be told was a foreign concept to me personally.
Hmm. Once you opened up that part of your brain, did the stories flow, or what, did it close back up because, of course, you just had your first child, and that, if nothing else, can remind a person about the pragmatic needs of the world more than anything else?
I think to some degree, but I think it was more the former. I think that really, once I started thinking creatively, that's been an ongoing thing since then. Yeah, and again, I don't remember that. I have no memory of the connective tissue between that experience and getting into podcasting.
Sure.
But especially in podcasting, my mind is always turning with new podcast ideas constantly. Either things to do differently or addition to my existing show, or totally different shows. I'm always up for collaborating. I'm always up for new ideas. I'm always coming up with my new ideas. So yeah. Once I started thinking creatively, it's been a constant. It's a low level hum in the back of my head at all times, and sometimes it's at the front of my brain. If something clicks in the back of my head, like, that's a great idea, then it'll move to the front of my head, and then I won't let go of it until I either execute on it, or I'm just honest with myself and say, you're not able to execute on that idea, and then I'll have a decent ability to push it to the side and move on with my day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
It totally does, because I have ideas buzzing in my head at all times, but yeah. I've been coming up with stories since I was young. So it's fascinating to me to think about, you know, just the different way your brain works than mine, and how, you know, it took this pure idea of this story. Also, kudos to the maker of the Parking Lot movie for literally igniting your creativity, such yeah. that the door, you know, kind of creaked open slightly to the creative part. And then you were like, and then the whiff of the idea of the DJs as a good story popped out, and then doors open. That's it. Now you got ideas, yeah. From now on, but that it's as simple as that. And to the point where, you know, when people talk about, You know, if you've been coming up with stories for a long time and you're, you know, you hit a wall or you can't write anymore, I think of that literal door. Like, it's like, no, the door's just shut for a second. It's not locked. It's just shut. You know, sometimes you need the door shut. Sometimes you don't. So occasionally it goes that way. Occasionally it doesn't. Some people, that door went directly off the hinges. There's no way they're getting that door back on every minute of every day. And it's funny that you mention that, you know, you have this deluge of ideas for new podcasts. And I want to get into the podcast in a moment. But like that previous to now, when we realized that this was sort of our first pseudo face-to-face interaction and true conversation with one another, we've been talking online for years, right? And a number of our conversations have been bandying about ideas, have been like, hey, I have this. Can we flesh this out? And then I'm like, yeah, absolutely we can. And then we've like discussed for, you know, ages on, we have messenger threads forever long of like ideas and different, could it go like this? Maybe like this, maybe like that. And then like, I wait, sometimes there were moments where we'd stop talking and then I'd have an idea related to what we talked about. And I was like, wait, here's a very long text about what I just had as an idea based on your thing. Like, because that's, I mean, my brain works like that. I'm constantly coming up with ideas. You want to discuss ideas? I'll help you. I got 14 million of them. And the beauty of what I think is my superpower is that I don't hold on to them too tightly. Like you mentioned this idea that there is a time and a place to tell a story. I also think that there's a time and a place for you to worry about that story. Like the story's out there, you know, like the other girl who made the documentary about that. That story was out there, ignited her too. She got that idea. She was like, yeah, absolutely. So sometimes, you know, you don't have to feel bad. If you come up with an idea and you're like, this is a great idea. Why don't I have the time to do this? Why don't I have the bandwidth to do this? Don't worry. Especially in a scenario like this, that's the other thing where I love this podcast because I get to toss ideas out. Anybody who listens, guys, don't feel bad. If I say something cool and it inspires you to do a project, that would be the happiest moment of my life to know that some random joke I made on this podcast inspired you to write or create anything. Ugh. That's my whole life. That's what I want to do, is to help people to access their creativity and create things and do stuff like that. So it's funny that you mentioned that, like, oh, the door's open, but I don't know how it works. And my relationship with you has been all about creative brainstorming and like total connecting on like, yeah, here's 1,000 ideas. Let's do this. Like,
well, I think. I haven't always, since that period when that started, I haven't been, oh, here's a bunch of stories that need to be told. That was kind of a unique thing. I think what's been around for me a lot longer, quite a bit longer, is wanting to entertain. You know, because when I first started playing guitar, I played guitar at youth group for years, like 20 something years. And, just hacked away at the guitar. I'm not a guitarist. Don't make that mistake. But I've wanted to entertain, and I've always been a huge fan of comedy, and I've always followed the talk shows. I was the first one of anybody I knew that really was willing to sit down and watch Conan O'Brien when he started in September of 1993. Like, people relentlessly made fun of me when he was having book authors and Dr. Ruth and just horrible guests on there. I watched every night, you know, and I loved Letterman, and I loved, you know, I used to have tons of stuff on VHS. I had Johnny Carson's Last Week, you know, of broadcasting on The Tonight Show. So, I mean, like, volumes and volumes of poorly labeled VHS tapes of TV shows. And like, I always wanted to entertain. You know, when I was graduating, I nearly applied for an unpaid internship at Turner in Atlanta just to get anywhere near the entertainment business. And like, well, it doesn't pay anything. I'm like, oh, I'll figure it out. And my parents shockingly were like, sure, give it a shot. But then I don't remember why I didn't apply. I think my practical side took over. But I've always not necessarily wanted to tell stories, but I've always wanted to entertain. And I think if I wasn't so risk averse, if I wasn't so afraid of rejection, if I was more self-confident, you know, we talked about those other paths I could have taken. I would have taken that path. I would have taken some sort of entertainment path. And that's not an easy one either, because I listen to a lot of podcasts of entertainers, you know, interviewing other entertainers. And that sounds like a really difficult life. You know, it doesn't sound as glorious as everyone thinks it is. But I might have gone that direction, if not for those reasons, because I do like to entertain.
Mm. Yeah, I think there is something very specific about doing an interview show, certainly like certain types, certainly in our past, you know, the David Lettermans, the Johnny Carson, there was something where it was like, they do it, but they're who they are as the entertainer is slightly distant because they're just, you know, presenting someone else in that scenario. Whereas I think shows like Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel, those guys take opportunities, even Conan O'Brien, really, took opportunities to do their own sketches and to create stuff they could mm-hmm. do. So it's not just them presenting somebody else. It's like, look at Jimmy Fallon being totally weird and funny and hilarious. And did you know he also had a guest? Like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Yeah. And all of those people are going to get together for a sing-along at some point, which is like, what?
Right.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. But it's really just a matter of framing what you're interested in into projects that can fulfill what you're trying to do. So how did you then get into podcasting? Which came first, podcasting or comedy?
Podcasting, actually. Yeah, I wanted to, the only thing I knew about comedy was stand-up. They were synonymous. If you said comedy, that, you know, obviously sitcoms and comedy acting, but if you said doing comedy, that meant stand up to me. I wasn't aware of anything else. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of years, I was like, I want to do stand up comedy, but again, no self confidence, would never do it. And then an older guy in my office and his wife took a class at Addison Improv, a stand up class. And I went to his showcase, didn't have any context for that. I was like, oh my gosh, this guy that he's going to do comedy on stage in front of a crowd. And he did pretty well. I was like, man, that's really ballsy. That's really impressive. But that wasn't enough to put me over the top. And then there's kind of parallel paths because one of the companies used to send out at Christmas time a video of them lip syncing to some popular pop song. Like everyone in the company, it's extremely well done. And a couple of times I sent an email, like a long email, just a funny email in response to their video. And it was really well received. Now that's not comedy writing, but it's kind of comedy writing. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. They liked my material. I'm using air quotes, my material. they responded well. And so I was like, oh, maybe I should blog. And I briefly got into blogging because I wasn't even aware of, I might have been aware of podcasting, but that was it, maybe. And after about 2 months, I realized I hate reading and I also hate writing. I don't like reading or writing. I hate both of those. Like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? I don't like this. And then somehow I became aware of podcasting. I was like, well, it must be much easier just to turn on a microphone and talk than to write an article and edit an article and edit an article and then edit it again and then release. Like, that's, I hate that. I hate that whole workflow. Talking has to be easier. So I did it what everyone else does. So I reached out to a friend and I bought a Yeti Blue microphone and, you know, I downloaded Audacity and I started a podcast because there's zero barrier to entry into podcasting. And this has nothing related to comedy yet, other than I needed a creative outlet. I desperately needed one, and podcasting seemed like the route to go. And it was. And so fast forward, finally, you meet a lot of people in podcasting. Surprisingly, you end up in a community of podcasters and really eccentric, interesting people. And one of them, is a guy named Derek Glasscock, who did a show called The Wild Pitch that he shut down, and now he's doing Pop-Up Filmcast. Both were great shows. But I found out that he did improv up in Milwaukee. And that didn't surprise me in the least. Derek's a very, very funny guy. Like, he's innately funny. He's just naturally funny. And I was like, wait a second, improv? What is that? And because if you said improv, then I would say, oh, whose line is it anyways? Right? I've seen that, you know, with Wayne Brady So I was like, well, if Derek represented kind of the everyman to me, if he can do it, at some point someone has the idea, if so-and-so can do it, then I can do it. And I didn't think it was as funny as Derek, but I was like, well, he's kind of the everyman. He's just a guy I know out in the world. He's doing it in Milwaukee of all places, which I'm from Milwaukee. So that, that resonated. So I got on the internets and I Googled comedy clubs or improv something. I know what it was. But I'm mixing up the story. But I Googled comedy clubs and I came across the Dallas Comedy House, and I was reading through. I got really lucky because not most comedy clubs don't also do training. They don't also have a school, but this one did, and very much in the tradition of UCB. And so I'm reading through the different types of classes, and I'm reading about storytelling. I don't like stand up. Yep, I recognize that. And sketch, of course, I certainly know about that. Big fan of Saturday Night Live, all those things. And then I'll be like, improv. What is improv? And I read about improv. I apologize for the long story, but this is pertinent. As you know, Amy, and as many listeners part of your show know, there's a spectrum of comedy. And on one end is stand-up, and on the other end is improv. And what I mean by the spectrum is stand-up is very individual. You are up on stage by yourself. You write your own material. You know, on the spectrum, it's not very collaborative. It's competitive. Stand-up is very competitive. Larry. On the other end is improv, which is nothing but supportive and collaborative and encouraging and yes-anding and making the other person look good and making, you know, it's not about you. You're not going for the laugh. And as I read through the nature of improv, I was like, that's me. I'm all of those things. I'm attracted to all those things. I finally found this thing, this part of comedy that I didn't know existed that fits my personality perfectly, because to me, it felt much less risky to be up on stage with a group of people who everyone's mutual goal is to support each other. Because if I fall on my face, I'm not going to look like I fell on my face, because I've got four other people that are going to, or whatever, that are going to help me in that moment. So I did it. So I signed up for improv classes. And that's how I got into comedy.
Yeah. How many years into podcasting did you find DCH?
Three or three and a half.
Three.
I got into podcasting the summer of 2016, and I signed up for my first improv class in March of 2019.
Oh.
Yeah. So almost 3 years.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Now, do you feel like your study with Dallas Comedy House changed the way that you created your podcast?
Yes. Well, that's still evolving. It certainly influences it, because the problem is that I took a year's worth of classes and then the world shut down, right?
Indeed.
I took the full curriculum of improv classes at DCH. Then I was, my graduation showcase was the last onstage performance at DCH, period. Because then they were like, oh my gosh, we have to shut down for the pandemic. And then the club went bankrupt the following August.
Yeah.
So I graduated March, shuts down, bankrupt in August. So like the comedy club that I was then going to take all my training and go be a comedian or do improv disappeared. Right. And all the things I was going to do on my show, as I'm figuring out how to do more actual comedy on my show, I couldn't do it because no one was spending time. You couldn't spend time together. And we're still in that place. Like, people are still a little bit nervous. I can't do the things that I was going to roll into my show 2 years later. So the answer is I had plans, very specific plans, and haven't been able to live out those plans yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I wondered if your, like, the things that you learned changed the way that you were creating your podcast. But I realize now, especially given your explanation of when you found improv, you finally found an art that fit you, where you were like, this, finally, I found a place where it doesn't feel so scary. It feels like something I could really do and use the skills I have in this place. That I suppose that would mean that that's who you were already. So your podcast was already, you know, pleasant and had a good time and was, you know, fun and did bits and whatnot. And that it didn't change it too much for you or in the format of it. I also understand the idea of having these great ideas, and then the pandemic kind of pulled the rug out from underneath those ideas.
Right.
So And there's a lot, I think many of us who, you know, were learning and putting away educational info in ourselves for use. And then, you know, now it's been 2 years and it's like, has this knowledge atrophied? In the case of improv, I would say never. I think that it's almost like riding a bike where it's like, you know how to do it. It might not be great at first. You're going to fall off the bike a couple times. But like, you know how to do it, so you can do it, you know? Other thing with reference to, I did all the classes and then the theater disappeared. Most improv, especially in the region where you're at, most improv is fluid such that if you walk in and say, yeah, they might make you take a class or two, but like if you want to do a show at a place and you're like, hey, I've taken classes somewhere else, I'd like to do this show or the jam or whatever, the improv jam, they'll let you right in. You know, the community building is as open and welcoming and taking care of each other as the artwork, as the art itself. So I find that no matter what, there are a couple of new Dallas spots, that popped up, during the pandemic. And I bet you if you walked in and told them like, I'd like to be part of the jam or something, they'd let you do it, or you could get involved with meeting new comedians. Once, in a couple, I don't know how long until you can see each other in person, but hopefully soonish, and then connect in that way. But your lack of being able to do comedy hasn't stopped the creative building of ideas. You started with a Gravity Beard podcast, and that was going well, but now you've got like 47. How did the tripling of ideas develop, and how are you maintaining these things?
Oof. I'm going to try to come up with a concise way of answering that question. Gravity Beard was the point of that show was just to have a creative outlet for me. So I did something kind of different every week. And it was serving that purpose wonderfully. And we did lots of crazy stuff. Basically the idea was if I came up with an idea, we would try it on the show. If it worked, we would do it again. If it didn't, it would never see the light of day. And so there was lots of examples of both of those. But eventually it's hard to create content every week, especially doing something different, because there's not a workflow you can establish. And so I had to come up with something on the off weeks that was consistent. And that's where This Week Today came from. And so we started that a year into the podcast, and that's a whole story. And we did some other, and then the Facebook group came in 2018. That's a whole other story. And that was world building and community building and took on a life of its own. And that's where staff meetings came from. And so things were born out of Gravity Beard that were legitimate projects on their own. And so I do have two separate podcasts. I've got This Week Today, and I've got Armchair Radio, which is a weekly sports podcast. But all the other stuff that I have are really things that I've curated out of Gravity Beard and put in their own feeds because they deserve their own home. So I did This Week Today is certainly my primary show. There is a staff meetings where I've collected all of those episodes. I've got another feed with This Week Today archives called Deep Cuts, which is really fun to go back and listen to those old episodes. I just launched Three Room Apartment, which is actually staff meetings were born out of Gravity Beard. Actually, staff meetings were born out of This Week Today, which was born out of Gravity Beard. And then the Three Room Apartment was a bit I stole off the radio station that was born out of staff meetings. But again, it was something that justified its own place. And so I've just created a feed. And that's an ongoing thing. We still do the Three Room Apartment. That's the idea where celebrities die in threes and we vote on whether or not they're eligible or they're worthy to get into a Three Room Apartment. And it's a whole thing.
It's fun.
And I've got lots of other ideas that I could launch other podcasts, but these were things that were born out of previous things. And that's how I've got so many feeds at the moment.
Yeah. It's funny though. You're like, oh, it's not a big deal. I just do like six different things. It's all right. Like I get from your point of view, cause I like know how they develop and then like how you're putting the stuff together that I'm like, yeah, I get how for you, it doesn't seem like a lot, but for a person who potentially is listening and is like, I have one idea. You have 17 ideas. Like, you're right that you did. You developed it out of like a single idea. Now tell me what you're thinking.
Usually when you come up with a podcast, you have an idea and you go do that idea. There's literally 2 million examples of that. My show, if you want to put it another way, was an idea incubator because I didn't want to be pitted into a corner. I thought doing the same thing every week would be boring, et cetera, et cetera. So I did that on purpose. The downside is you'll never have a big audience because no one knows what your show's about. They don't know if they should be in your audience. And they either like how it's jolting from one week to the next, the contrast, or they don't. And I had a very small audience, but I didn't care because it was an idea incubator. It was scratching that itch. And so it's like, I'm not doing Gravity Beard anymore, but if I come up with a crazy idea, I have a feed that has, I have a home for that crazy idea that I can go do. I could do it once or twice and be done with it and move on with that idea. I don't have time to do staff meetings at the moment. There might be a point in the future where that comes back. So that's not an active project. I'm not doing new interviews for the interview show. I will get around to catching up on the apartments, the 3-room apartments. And then this week today in Armchair Radio, those are shorter shows. Those are 30 or 35 minute shows. And I've got a very specific workflow on how to execute those. That's where my practical brain combines really well with my artistic brain. Is that if you have both of those sets of skills, then it can make your life a lot easier just in terms of execution. So I have those because of health issues I'm dealing with and time constraints and pandemic. I pared down this week today even to a shorter show than it used to be, and so I'm very much a taskmaster and I do everything exactly the same way. Which I don't know if that fits with an artistic person or not, but I have both brains and I just combine the two, and that's how I do it.
I mean, you've mentioned the phrase workflow a number of times, and I think that there's something smart to take from that, which is that, like, there are a lot of ways, a lot of art that you need to create that you need ways to get it done. Like, there's ideas, and then there's actually enacting a task, right? And so you're discussing this idea of workflow and the idea that, you know, you have a specific method in which you can accomplish these tasks with the limited amount of time that you have. I don't think there's anything unartistic about that at all. I think that's just smart production management. Like, there are, and to be honest, in the art world, certainly the professional art world, there are entire people whose entire jobs are just that. Like, I'm the person who makes sure people get it done, right? Like, that's an entire career. That's a career that I opted out of. I was going to be a stage manager, which is the organizer of theater productions. For years, I was like so close to working on Broadway. And then a voice in my head said, if you become a Broadway stage manager, that's what you are for the rest of your life. Is that what you want? Right. And I was like, oh no, I do not want that. Like, that is a definite good career move for sure. It would keep me in the industry, but it would force me to just be, like you mentioned, the workflow taskmaster and not be able to come up with a million ideas and do different things and develop whatnot, you know, and, you know, live the freelance lifestyle that we earlier established we both enjoy as well. So I wouldn't discount yourself as far as like workflow makes me not an artist. No, workflow means that you're an artist who accomplishes the task.
Done. Well, let me say this, because the other thing that is true about me is I really like to help people. And so if someone's, this is going to sound strange, but I'll make this offer. If someone's listening to this and they're like, because I'm a very good executor. So if someone's listening and they're saying, I've got this great idea, but I don't have the slightest idea how to execute it, I don't have to understand your idea that well. If you want to reach out to me one way or the other, and we can have a short conversation about how I can make some possibly helpful suggestions on how you can execute your idea, I'm willing to do that. I'll do it for a total stranger. I don't care, because I like helping people, and two, I like helping people realize their ideas, because chances are there's a bunch of people listening that have much better ideas than I do. They just may not be able to know exactly how to execute it. I want to be that part of the equation. Because the other thing we haven't touched on is that, I don't know, it's several years ago, I started the Underdog podcast community for independent podcasters. And it was just going to be a small collection of my indie pod friends. And it grew into 3,500 people. But we created a culture in that group of, we're not going to be jerks to each other. We're going to be just like improv. We're going to support each other in any way possible. That's what this group is about. It's not going to be overly promotional. We do almost none of that in the group. But one thing we are going to be known for is be encouraging, positive. And if someone has a question, I want to see a dozen people jump in there with very good practical answers on how to help that person do that thing. So I like to do that. I don't have, people don't reach out to me. I'm not known as a consultant or, but I'm offering it if people want to. I'm a very good executor on ideas, even when I don't understand them.
Yeah. No, that's an excellent skill and an excellent offer for sure. Absolutely. Had I the bandwidth, I'd offer the same, but I won't. No. So call Chris. Another thing that you're great at that I want to talk about right before we get to the end of the episode is the community that you've built, right? Gravity Podcast, while it had a small audience, it had a very caring, connected audience. And when you built that Facebook group, it really got people to connect on various levels. And now there's two different community podcast groups within your podcast creation. You made these shows. You're not just creating the content of the shows and putting them out in the ether for nothing. There are people all across the world who are friends now because of you. You've created this world and this community. And I think that's a part of art that people don't like to think about. The fact that they have to do the marketing. I mean, I've been to a number of podcast conventions, and the number one thing that they talk about is creating the community around what you're doing. So you're great at that. How did that develop for you, and how do you feel about maintaining that?
Well, the Gravity Beard Interns Facebook group was started as, well, first of all, it was not my idea. My friend Chris Brayton, who is much better at it than I am, because he has a good Facebook group and a successful podcast. I was at his house in California, and he said, you need to start a Facebook group for your show, because he'd done one for his. It was very successful. And I don't know why I do this, but my instinct is to always dismiss ideas. I don't know why. I need to stop doing that, honest, because he's given me two or three ideas that I've executed and that they've always been successful. There's even a pattern there, so it's really dumb on my part. But he said, start a Facebook group, and I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And so I went home. That was in April, and two or three weeks later, I was at work, and I was at my computer, and I didn't want to work. And I was like, I think I'm going to start this Facebook group. And there's a hesitancy, probably a good one, that you don't want to invite people to your Facebook group because people aren't too, they're just, people can be annoyed by that. But I thought, I'm going to do it anyways, because all they have to do is click dismiss. They just click one button and they don't join the group. But I did it. I started the group as a social experiment, because I'd been in podcasting for this point, I don't know, a couple of years, whatever. And I quickly realized, oh my gosh, I know English-speaking people all over the world. That's super fascinating. Plus, I'm old enough now that I've got childhood friends and comedy friends and friends from all different times and places in my life, you know, neighbors, family members, whatever. But I'm the one thing in common. I'm this single thread with all these different people from different times and different places. And I just decided this Facebook group is going to be a social experiment to see what happens when I put all these people in the same pot and just mix it all together and create a tone and a culture, which, again, I wanted to be positive and funny and excuse me. And one of my rules was, we're not going to talk about politics or religion or anything that's happening in the real world that's even slightly polarizing, because not that those things aren't worth our time and energy and emotions and efforts, but you can do that literally any other place or time on the internet, right? So I intentionally said this is going to be a tiny corner of the internet where we can escape from that for however much time we want to. That's just going to be, and it's never been an explicit rule. It's been an implicit rule. And people seem to like it. So that was one of the rules. So if somebody posted something polarizing, I would delete it. And it didn't really, it happened rarely. And so I threw all these people in the pot and mixed them all together. And it just turned into this thing. And then the way it evolved, again, not my idea, Keith Gala, the other co-host of the Pop-Up Filmcast, he posted something in there. Okay, because the name of the group, Gravity Beard Interns, was also Chris Brayton's idea. He said you should call them interns. And that's because at the end of Gravity Beard, for some period of time, I had this fake narrative during the closing credits where I was struggling with trying to find an intern to hire to help out on the show. And it got into this whole thing and got really dramatic, and it got really elaborate. And then I just got bored of it and I just stopped doing it. But off of that thread, he said, you should call your listeners interns and call the group the Gravity Beard Interns. And so I did. And so Keith is the one that kind of took up the mantle of, hey, this is, we're all interns here working for a fake company. That was his idea. And then everyone else jumped on. And then it just took on a life of its own. And then it's kind of become, I would describe the group as a combination of The Office and Seinfeld. Because a whole nother story, eventually the tagline for the group became serious conversations about the dumbest things ever. That was in a text thread with Paul Chomo and I. And that's where that came from. And so people love that idea. It's adults pretending, which you and I are familiar with in improv, but not everyone is. But adults naturally love that. They love a safe place where they can do that, act like a child. And that's what it became. And then there's a set of Facebook groups called a group where we pretend to be dot, dot, dot. It could be in an HOA. It could be a slice of bread. It could be we're all ants, whatever. I love world building and I love adults pretending to do something else. And so I spun off a group called Gravity Beard Incorporated where we strictly just act like we're part of this giant corporation that's somehow run by interns. Now, all of this has taken a huge hit in terms of engagement by the pandemic. Everyone's just, everything feels very heavy and people aren't engaging. But there was a time when we were getting, I think at the peak, we were getting 15 to 20,000 interactions every 30 days. It was something
Whoa.
Like, yeah, so someone was interacting with the group like once every 2 minutes, 24 hours a day.
Wow.
And that's a level of activity that was probably carried by about 50 people.
Yeah.
Like that's the level of engagement we had. And this group had a total of 225 people in it at the time. And about 40 or 50 people were the most engaged. And it was literally 2 to 3 minutes every day, 24 hours a day. Now it's probably 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 every 30 days, which is still a pretty high number. But we were getting crazy, crazy engagement. Yeah. And that's not the goal. That wasn't the goal. The goal is to create a fun place for us to hang out and play.
And it's still there.
It's still there. Yeah.
Yeah, I check it every day. I'm always looking at little things here and there. Yeah. It's always fun stuff for sure. Both of the groups are fun. The interns group is fun for just wackiness and fun pictures and like, let's discuss this weird thing in the world. And then I really enjoy the rabbit holes that Gravity Beard Inc. goes down where we're like really pretending like we're in this office and something has happened and everyone's dealing with it with their own little characters that they've developed. Like at first I was like, I don't know how I'm going to develop this character. And then I was like, what am I worried about? Like developing characters is my bread and butter. I'm not going to worry about how it's going to happen. Like, yeah, it's not like there's someone who's going to be like, you're doing it wrong. Like, nope. It's fine. I mean, unless I swing in with a bunch of like Trump articles and I'm like, hey, you guys want to join QAnon with me? Like, other than that, I feel like I'm good no matter what.
Well, and I think we would cultivate that a lot more, but I've gotten super busy, unfortunately, and plus other things. And like I said, everyone's feeling a little heavy right now. I think there's going to be a time in the future when that heaviness is not there and we're going to be more in the mood to play. And I think there'll be a resurgence there. I hope there is. Mm-hmm. I just created that at a time when I felt like it needed to be separated off as a separate group, but it was just at a time when it was a bad set of circumstances. So it exists and we still have fun playing in there, but I think it'll pick up more sometime in the future.
Well, also you're right. It's been heavy for a while. And I think when you created the Inc. Group that, it was very much a, hey, nothing's fun in the world right now. So let's try to make a fun corner. And we have already all agreed that we're going to be kind and nice to each other. So let's also play in a way that we could play in person, but we don't. We all live across the world from each other. And then B, nobody will leave their house to see each other. So let's just pretend that we've got this stuff going on. Also fun for those of us like you and I who are freelancers that don't have office politics. And I get to pretend I do in a fun way as opposed to like really dealing with it. Like when I see people actually complain about stuff in their offices, I'm like, I'm so sorry. This is your real life. And then I'll take that exact thing that's happened to to them and I bring it to the group and I make it much wilder. Instead of like, this one guy keeps bringing his dog and everyone tells him to stop, but he keeps bringing the dog. I like go over to the Gravity Beard Inc. and I'm all like, guys, is it fine if I brought my hedgehog? It's in the office already. By the way, I lost it. Like, that's like, it's just like, how far can it get immediately? And it's just like, well, a fun thing.
The answer is yes, bring your hedgehog.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's a crazy world. It's a big, big, crazy world that, that's keeps growing. Like we have a big campus. That's filled with all kinds of crazy stuff. We don't even have time to get into it, but it's a deep,
there's a
deep
lot
world.
Of wonderful detail. And to shout out back to your workflow, the effort that you put in to organize everything about like certain episodes, like you did this whole organizational thing that I thought was so endearing and wonderful, where you were like, hey, are you joining us for the first time? Here's a series of episodes you can listen to understand how to join in. If you come to this group and you're like, I don't even know how to step into this room, like here's a couple episodes you could listen to that'll like ease you into the idea of what we're doing, so that like and it's just such a great resource to have, to be like, hey, you want to join this funny thing? Yeah, but you kind of need to know a little bit, so here's some info about what you need to know before you start playing. It's like a D&D group or like LARPers where you're like, okay, before you put on your costume and become your character, read this. This is about what the world is that we're creating and what we're doing, you know. And it's so helpful in that scenario. I think things like that, both like in-person LARPing and then online stuff like the groups like this and the groups where you're like, we all pretend to be a piece of bread. Like there's something great about, you know, adults needing this creative resource to connect with one another, to be able to be silly. Like we need to give ourselves permission to be silly, because in the world, there's a lot of things in our way. There's like walls up and there are things that, you know, we have in front of us that are like, you need to deal with this first. This is more important. And like, all that stuff is so hard and like keeps you from playing the way you did as a child. You have to deal with all this adulting. So it's nice when there are people who put in the effort to create a world for you to walk into whenever you feel like, and connect with other people and know that it's going to be like fun, cool people. I mean, there are people that I'm friends with from Gravity Beard. I've never seen them. The other day, somebody posted their family on Christmas and I almost said, which one is you? And then I was like, you can't ask that. That's not an acceptable question to ask. Like you need to find out, search through their photos until you figure out which one is them. Like, and I talked to this girl literally, I mean, all the time on Facebook, like constantly commenting on each other's things, talking about different stuff. Like we are in it. And yet somehow I was like, I realize I have no idea what this woman looks like. Like, and it's great. How wonderful is that? That we can have this community that surpasses even, you know, what your face looks like.
To that specifically, what I would say is, you know, there is plenty of room for cynicism about the internet and social media, but you can carve out your own little corner of it that doesn't have to be that way, where you can put that aside. And I guess. This sounds really weird, but I really do. I would say that the original Gravity Beard Interns Facebook group experiment was a smashing success. And I get a lot of satisfaction out of that. I get the fact that I did create something. There's not a huge audience. I'm not making any money from it. I don't care about that. But it worked exactly the way I wanted it to, and that's very gratifying. It's, you know, the people have been brought together from all different places, all different types of people, and it's a positive place. You know, that was the goal of the experiment, and the experiment worked. And when you have, and I call that a success, and success feels good. So it feels good that the group worked. And and another thing, you know, you asked at some point, you kind of, it's about how comedy has influenced maybe some of the things. And, improv has definitely influenced how I've approached those things. You know, and I think I'm naturally inclusive. I naturally want things to be positive. I don't like a lot of fighting for no reason over dumb stuff. There's no time in this life for that. But improv has encouraged that. You know, I try to, like you said, step into a world where people don't feel lost and intimidated. You know, improv is the most inclusive form of comedy, and that's a long conversation of how improv works itself out in real life, because there's lots of ways that it does that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is helpful in life, and it is helpful on the stage, and it is helpful in the virtual world as well. I think that it is a success what you've done to build this community, and you mentioned that, you know, things are going well, but you're not making any money from it. I would say that 99% of us who consider ourselves artists are creating things that don't make money, but are still worth our time, because they enrich us and potentially the people around us. And, you know, when I've gone to podcast conventions and we're talking about the success of how many listeners, the first thing they'll say is, you can't compare yourself to different people. Everyone has a different kind of audience. And the other thing is, you know, you can discount, I don't have thousands of listeners, but if you imagine literally 200 people in a room, that's a full room. That's a lot of people. And if you've got 200 listeners or 200 people who are connecting in your community, even though you're like, well, I'm not Joe Rogan, I don't have millions of listeners, you don't, you know, but those 200 people are having a great time.
Yeah.
And if each one of us individually could entertain 200 people, everybody be entertained. I mean, just find your little niche and be with your people. And like, you know, it's so funny, because it's like my initial connection with you was out of bonding over podcasting, not even our podcasts individually, what they were, but the act of creating it. Right. And that was how we connected, but other people connect in different ways. And now I'm friends with all these other people I never would have met. I never would have spoken to in the whole wide world if not for you, you know? And there's something really great about that. And that's something to feel as a deep success. If we can connect people, if we can help people in their lives feel a little pleasant, I mean, that's pretty much it. That's all I'm trying to do.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. Thank you for that. I think if there's, if you're old enough, then you get this reference. But the one thing that I relate to quite a bit is the B girl from the Blind Melon video from like 1994.
Yeah.
Like the whole video is this girl in a B costume, and she doesn't fit in anywhere until she finds the rest of the people in the B costumes. I relate to that specifically.
Yeah,
I think my whole life I felt like the little girl in the bee costume, and when I found improv, I felt like I found my people. And before that, when I found podcasting, I was like, I found my people. And that's funny, because I was in my 40s when I found both of those things. So I went a long time having not found my people, and that there was a lot of times when that didn't feel good, you know, especially in adolescence. It's really hard at those ages to not find your people. And I will credit the internet for both those things. You know, that's why I have a very positive opinion of the internet. Now, I recognize the pure evil horribleness of the internet. I'm not naive, but I credit the internet for helping me find my people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the internet is like a knife. You can use it badly if you'd like, but it's also very helpful as a tool.
Yeah.
You need one of those. Just go ahead and use it. Don't use it to stab people, but use it to cut things and get yourself through, you know, the wilderness if you need to, you know?
That's
absolutely.
Right. Or a nice slice of cake.
Yeah, there you go. What a positive spin. Slice of cake. Yeah. Let's do it.
Who doesn't like cake?
Oh, man. All right. One final question, then I will let you back to your exciting life. Tell me, what is the way that you are filling up your own creative cup? What makes the ideas start flowing? What are the things that are inspiring you? Or, you know, like, this is the television show that I'm watching, and that's what makes me feel better.
I think my existing projects, and even past projects that I think still have some life, like I said, once it started, it never stopped. And I guess maybe not everyone can relate to that, but to me, I'm always thinking about what I can improve in my, I'm pretty committed to the shows that I'm doing right now. So what can I do to improve those? And my existing projects are doing a pretty good job of filling my cup. Now that doesn't mean I don't still have that hum in the back of my mind of other things I'd like to do or additional things. And then just the hope of getting back to improv and back on a stage, you know, because I completed my journey as a student, but I never really got to transition into being a performer. Mm. And so in a way, hope is kind of filling my cup because I know that day is much closer than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. So, and there's still opportunities, you know, DCH is gone, but DCC reopened. Stomping Grounds is in town. So the hope of in the near future getting back on stage and then also building up my show with the additional components that I was going to do before the pandemic. Like that can still happen. You know, like for example, a long time ago, I reached out to you and said, "Hey, I'm in Austin all the time. I'd love to have you on the show just to nerd out about comedy because I could do that for hours." That possibility is still there. You know, there's going to be a point where it's easy and safe for us to get together in person again, and we're going to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I have a list of people that I want to get together with in person, and that opportunity is not passed. And so, you know, the easiest way to say that is hope. My existing projects and hope are what is filling my cup at the moment.
That's great. That's so nice. Hey, thanks, Toph, so much for being on this podcast. It's been really great to talk to you and to explore these topics with you.
Oh, it was an absolute thrill to get the invitation. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all of our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.